Hello and welcome to another episode of Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Kerry Cheshire. In this week's episode, we'll be checking in on what tax increases are on the horizon here in the People's Republic of Austin. We'll head down I-35 and see what's going on with Texas's most sacred shrine from Brandon Walton's. And we'll have an extended interview with Texas State Senator Connie Burton, who's facing re-election in Texas's only true swing district as it comes to state politics. And we'll hear a commentary from Tony McDonald on who wears the white hats and the black hats in Texas. Welcome back to Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Kerry Cheshire, joined today by Jacob Asmussen here in the People's Republic of Austin. Jacob represents our Central Texas Bureau and covers the city of Austin and other areas. Jacob, how are you this morning?
I'm doing well. I mean, I'd always be better if Hillary Clinton was in jail, but I'm doing pretty good.
Glad to hear it. Well, I would be doing better if it weren't already on the news horizon, already being talked about, that the city council is going to raise my taxes again.
Yeah, so that's always great news to know that your taxes are going up. So recently the council met to discuss next year's budget, right? And just some preliminary talks. They were talking about taxes, but there was no discussion on whether or not they should raise taxes, just by how much they're going to raise taxes.
Right. The city of Austin, already one of the most expensive places in the state of Texas, a very expensive place for people to live and for people to work. We've seen a lot of low-income residents have to leave the city because we have rampantly increasing appraisal growth and rampantly increasing taxes over the last couple of years.
Yeah, and their solution is to take more of the residents' money. You know, it's like if they went up to somebody who had $100 and say, all right, I see you've got 50 for your mortgage this year, you know, 20 for food and 10 for other stuff. Well, why don't we make affordability easier and take more of your money?
Right, right. Absolutely. And I think you've mentioned before, I know I've read your articles on the issue, the city of Austin has already raised taxes by 8%. Oh, I think 8 times out of the past 11 years.
That's right. Almost for the past decade, they've raised it 8%. And it's crazy. I mean, to think that taking more of people's money is going to make it easier for them to afford it is totally backwards. And the mayor actually said that he wants to raise it a little bit higher. He wants to err on that 8% side because they need more money in their reserves in case the state legislator next year comes in and says they can't raise it as much without voter approval.
Right. Of course, right now here in the state of Texas, if your city council raises your tax rate more than 8%, voters have the right to petition their government for a rollback election. The problem is that's been very onerous requirement, the petition requirement, city lawyers poke holes and all that, and it's been very, very difficult for citizens to actually do that. But it has kind of existed as an ipso facto cap on property tax increases. What the Texas legislature is trying to do is rein that down and make the election an automatic trigger. We saw legislation in the last session to lower that as low as 4%. That failed due to the stall tactics of the Texas House. But now Governor Greg Abbott is coming out and talking about lowering it to even 2.5%. But the thing that I find most contemptuous about this, Jacob, is they can raise taxes 250% if they want, as long as the citizens who elected them say it's okay.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, unless there are different officials in office that want residents to keep more of their money, that want them to spend it how they wish and to stimulate the economy and to be able to afford their houses easier, you know, we're going to continue to see this affordability problem get worse if there aren't some new decisions made pretty fast.
Right. Well, I think here in the city of Austin, it's the blueberry soup, the blueberry in the tomato soup of Texas. I think it's also the poster child for property tax reform. Jacob, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And next, we'll check in with Brandon Waltons, who runs the Capital Bureau here at Texas Scorecard. Brandon, I know that you checked in on the Alamo recently, going down to San Antonio to see what's going on with Texas's most sacred shrine. What is going on?
Yes. Yeah, so recently went down to San Antonio. So the city council there, I was listening, had an open period for citizens to go and voice their concerns about various issues. And the big issue that came up when I was there was the city's plan to move the cenotaph at the site of the Alamo. The cenotaph, of course, is a monument that's been there commemorating the 100th anniversary of the Alamo. So it was placed there around 1936 and has been there ever since.
That's right. It has been there ever since, and it's really been kind of the most interesting point of contention with all of this Reimagine the Alamo plan. I know that as viewers on our Facebook Live interview with Commissioner George P. Bush, and as he said in our endorsement interview where we chose not to endorse him for reelection, I couldn't really give a square answer on what was going to happen to the Cenotaph. It's owned by the city of San Antonio, but as you know, the General Land Office and the commissioner have a pretty big bully pulpit.
Big sway and big control over this Alamo Restoration Project, which is a project the city and the state are taking up over the next few years to restore a lot of the, not only the Alamo site itself, but a lot of the monuments and such around that area.
Well, and what's been most concerning is, you know, as you went to this meeting, I don't believe that the General Land Office was there.
Yeah, so we heard from lots of grassroots citizens, some that had driven up from all over the state, from Dallas-Fort Worth area, and all over to voice their concern. Surprisingly, there was no one there from the General Land Office.
No one there, and of course, the big concern with the movement of this cenotaph somewhere off the historic site is that then they could follow in a couple years later and remove it entirely. This is something that's happened with Confederate monuments all across the state and something that grassroots citizens have a right to be concerned about.
Exactly, and you know, the way a lot of these citizens see it, of course, is that this is not just a monument. This is essentially a tombstone to those who died on that battlefield, and by moving it to be at a park by the convention center, or as many suspect, moving it and just never really replacing it or moving it anywhere, is a big disrespect to those who fought for the freedom of Texas.
Well, and I think it's been the most physical expression of the concerns with this whole Reimagine the Alamo project, you know, with ideas of putting up a glass wall, of having an exhibit on frontier medicine, you know, really taking the focus away from the Texians who gave their lives there in 1836 so that we could be free.
Exactly. Grassroots citizens don't want this, the Alamo, to look like the Louvre. They want it to look like a place that is a big remembrance and big symbol of the freedom of Texas.
Well, that's right, Brandon. I think we're going to have to be especially vigilant moving forward. As you know, oftentimes when city councils or commissioners' courts have a meeting to listen to concerns, they already know what right. they're going to do. And I would expect the next meeting we would probably see some kind of action on this item.
Well, we'll be keeping an eye on it.
Thanks, Brandon.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's news digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, we're joined today by State Senator Connie Burton of Texas Senate District 10 up in Tarrant County, representing Colleyville, Fort Worth, and some other areas. Senator, how are you today?
Great. Thank you for having me on. How are you?
Doing very well. Well, Connie, you really took the world by storm, taking back SD 10 from somebody that Texans know very well. Former State Senator Wendy Davis, who, of course, launched a failed gubernatorial campaign against Greg Abbott. Talk a little bit about how that campaign worked and how you're putting the band back together for round two.
That's exactly correct. Yeah, I Tarrant County, as everybody knows, is an incredibly red district. We are very conservative here, and I helped a lot of people back in my activist days, helped a lot of good representatives get elected to the state house, but was still very frustrated that we had Wendy Davis as our state senator here in this district. And so, you know, after redistricting, all the senators drew straws to see how long the terms would be, because of course they're, you know, they don't all get elected at the same time. It's an every other year type thing. And we were fortunate in that Wendy Davis drew the 2-year straw. So even though she had gotten reelected, and this was, of course, along with Obama, you know, it was very much an Obama wave. We got a kind of a do-over in her, what I consider a do-over in her election. And so right away, even though she'd gotten reelected, you know, she drew the 2-year straw, so we were going to be able to, go after her in 2 years versus 4. And so I started looking for somebody to run against her. And at the end of the day, it was me. I was more than happy to step up and run against her. We got into the race very early on. As a matter of fact, we got into the race before she even filibustered down in Austin. And that was a huge gift to us. It gave us quite a bit of ID, not only in the district, not only in the state of Texas, but across the country. As you know, that became a very huge news item, right? And so ultimately, as you mentioned, she got out of the race and went on to run for governor and got soundly defeated. We still had a Democrat challenger, but we won the race. And so I just got through with my first four-year term, which was two sessions down in Austin. And now I am running again. And of course, we have another Democrat challenger. Just to kind of let people know, everybody might not know, this particular Senate seat is the only one in the state of Texas that could go Democrat or Republican just because of the way that it's districted. You know, there are certainly others throughout time that, you know, maybe have a tighter race, but it doesn't have to do with the way that it's districted, right? And so, you know, this is the seat that the Democrats very much come after because, of course, Wendy Davis had it at one time. She's a Democrat, and I'm a Republican and have it now. So they want to take this district back, but we're not going to let them.
Right. As you mentioned, it's only the real only kind of true swing district in the Texas Senate and one that has been held by both Democrats and Republicans. Connie, one of the things that I thought was most important about your victory is that it wasn't just a Republican victory. It was a real activist victory. You know, you weren't the polished, you know, Chamber mm-hmm. of Commerce candidate. Nobody had anointed you in oil. You were a Tea Party mom, and you came to Austin and you governed like one. You had one of the best ratings with our organization on the Fiscal Responsibility Index. I know you had high marks with Texas Right to Life, Young Conservatives of Texas, the Texas State Rifle Association, everyone else. Talk about how you were able to hold on to your conservative values down here in the People's Republic of Austin.
Right. You know, I always say, you know, as maddening as it is down there and frustrating as politics is, on the one hand, on the other hand, for me, it's just very simple. I don't know why people, elected officials, make it harder than it needs to be. I am for limited government, personal liberty, and free market. You know, that is what I'm for. And you know, it's just not hard for me. Every bill that comes by my desk, every bill that my whole team looks at, is based on those principles. And if it's going to grow government, and if it's going to tax the people more, we're not going to be for it. But, you know, another thing that I talk a lot about, what got me interested in running, there's lots of reasons, obviously. But what is so frustrating to me is that everybody has somebody down at Austin fighting for that government money to come to them, you know, whatever organization or business or special interest group, you know, I mean, they're just all day long, every day down in Austin, talking about why they need to have more of our money. So what's so frustrating is that the average individual doesn't have somebody down there
right,
fighting for them, looking at it from their perspective. And I love the fact that you mentioned that I was a mom, you know, that went down to Austin. I think that's what we need more of, right? I was a stay-at-home mom, you know, that got frustrated that there's so much government in our lives. Who better to go down there than somebody that, you know, is going to the grocery store, is taking their kids to the doctor, who, you know, is every day, leads an everyday normal life. And so it's very easy for me to go down there and look at it from the perspective of those of us that just want to earn a good living and push back on government, thinking that they have a right to more and more of our money.
Right. And one of the things that I think you've been perhaps the biggest champion on is ending the practice of tax-funded lobbying, where governmental entities like cities and counties and some even school districts will go and use taxpayer resources to often advocate against taxpayer interests. Can you talk about that?
So I learned about this practice when I was just an activist, and I was with another fellow activist, and we were reading up on something and, you know, realized, oh my gosh, this taxing entity actually hires a lobbyist to go down to Austin. And we started putting it all together, and it was so aggravating to me. It was like, wait a minute, our dollars are being used to pay a lobbyist to go down to Austin. And then, of course, as you dig more into this, since this lobbyist represents a taxing entity, what side do you think they're on when they go down to Austin to lobby, right? They're not on the side of the taxpayer, even though they should be, because that's who's paying their salary. They're on the side of the taxing entity. And it was no more apparent to me than this past legislative session. I'll get to that just in a moment. I want to first say that my first session down there, I authored legislation to stop taxpayer-funded lobbying because, first off, I don't see them in my office. I see the actual elected officials or talk to the actual elected officials. That's what we're all there to do. There is absolutely no reason for these elected officials to hire a lobbyist to go down and speak to me. That's not the job of the elected official, is to spend our money to send a lobbyist down. So I authored that legislation, which didn't go anywhere. People hadn't really even, elected officials down there hadn't even really thought about it. Wasn't really on their radar. So it took a lot of, you know, getting through to them to explain what was going on. When I talk about it here in the district, when I'm going around, you know, giving talks and speak of it, I mean, it's frustrating. It doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on. People are frustrated by that. Well, then this last legislative session, particularly since we were working so hard on trying to get some sort of property tax relief for average homeowners and business owners, it was very apparent to all the elected officials because the taxpayer-funded lobbyists were down there in force, you know, trying to kill our legislation that would help homeowners and business owners with their property taxes. So once again, it was so obvious how wrong this practice is. Because again, our dollars, our taxpayer dollars, were being used to fund these lobbyists who were down there trying, and I might add, successful in killing property tax legislation that would have helped both business and homeowners. So it's a travesty. Last session, I just was working on a transparency bill, a reporting bill on this, just to try to get that through. And I gained traction on that. Still didn't get it through. But I will tell you, by the end of the session, I think it became very apparent to a lot of the legislators down there what a travesty this practice is. So I'm hoping next session we're going to be successful in getting rid of this practice.
Right. Well, I'm glad that you brought up the session, because that session is very important, especially for Senate District 10, because you're not just a Republican. You're a very conservative Republican who really moves the kind of median of the chamber to the right. And due to the 3/5 rule, you know, Senate District 10 is very, very important, because if it were to fall to the Democrat hands, it would empower perhaps one lone Republican senator from West Texas to partner with the Democrats and stop a lot of this conservative reform, like ending taxpayer-funded lobbying, property tax reform, strengthening the state spending limit. Talk a little bit about what's going on in SD 10 right now. I know that you've got a Democrat who's out campaigning hard. I know I've talked to members of your campaign team. They're out campaigning hard. How do you think that it's looking right now? And is the temperature and volume just going to escalate as we head on into November?
It likely will. But, you know, I will tell you, you mentioned it at the very beginning, and I appreciate that. You know, we worked so very, very hard in our first election. It was an 18-month run. I feel like we really ran a flawless campaign, because, you know, we stick to the issues that are important to the constituents of SD 10. We run a very grassroots driven campaign, which means, you know, we are working with people who live here in the district that are motivated because, you know, they have the same beliefs that I do. I'm fighting for the same beliefs that they are. So we're going to continue that. You know, we did not have a primary challenger, which I'm very grateful for. You know, I always say everybody deserves a primary challenger. I think it keeps everybody honest. But however, you know, if you're going to run against me, you can't get to the right of me. So, you know, I was very glad to see that nobody tried, and that we could continue to fundraise during that primary election for the needed cash that we're going to need for what's going to end up being a very expensive general election, because as we've talked about, this is the seat that the Democrats really want to take back. So there's going to be a lot of money pumped in, but it doesn't scare us. We're just going to continue to do what we've been doing. We were knocking on doors, you know, at the very beginning of the campaign season. We've continued to knock on doors through the primary, even though we didn't have a primary election. We got all our highway signs out. We delivered yard signs. Our supporters are so awesome. Even though, again, we didn't have a primary challenger, everybody was asking for yard signs. We're showing the Democrats that we are going to be a force to be reckoned with. And you know, nothing is going to scare us. We're going to work just as hard as we did last time. We're building our team as we speak. We have a goal of 250,000 doors.
Wow.
To knock. Yes. Governor Abbott is absolutely on board. He's already committed to us of coming into the district to help us. Of course, Lieutenant Governor is on board for exactly the reasons that you mentioned. We just had an in-district fundraiser that he attended, and we were happy to say that we raised $50,000 at that fundraiser. I'm continuing to, you know, fundraise individually, as well as, you know, getting out into the district, speaking to, you know, constituents. You know, we're just going to continue to do what we've always done. We're going to show people that, you know, I did what I said I was going to do the last two sessions. I went down and I represented the taxpayer down in Austin. I believe in limited government, personal liberty, free market economics, and I'm going to continue to do that. And while, you know, I don't want to, you know, people hearing that we raised that amount of money, and that's a lot of money, of course, but we're talking about could be as much as $4 million race,
right?
This Senate district race is. So even though that's a good amount of money, I don't want anybody sitting back thinking, oh, she's got enough money. It's by far enough money, because it's going to be very expensive. So, but you know what I appreciate so very much? We just launched our monthly giving campaign. And it's for those that want to donate. We're calling it 2018 because we want victory in 2018, obviously. And so we're asking people to donate $20.18 a month from now until November, because, you know, some people can block walk. Some people can deliver signs. Some people can make phone calls. Some people can make large donations. And some people, you know, what they can do is give that $20 a month to this campaign, which is just as important as the $20,000 donation. I was very pleased and proud to say in our last election, we had the most individual donations of any Senate campaign, almost 1,000 separate individual donations. And that just goes to show, you know, how much base support we have. And we want to continue that through this election.
Right. Well, this is Carrie Cheshire with Texas Scorecard Radio, joined by Connie Burton, who was with Take Back SD10. Now she's with Keep SD10, reporting from the battleground of Keep Texas Red in Tarrant County. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Senator.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
An Austin lobbyist recently penned a blog post titled, "Empower Texans, White Knights in Disguise?" Next, we'll hear from Empower Texans General Counsel Tony McDonald on how we don't wear any disguises.
Are folks in the Austin lobby starting to catch on that we at Empower Texans mean what we say about our mission and objectives? With this week's Texas Scorecard Radio commentary, I'm Tony McDonald. I was recently entertained to read a blog post by Austin ethics attorney Andrew Cates entitled "Empower Texans, White Knights in Disguise." Cates is a liberal Democrat and a lobbyist for the Texas Nurses Association, who also blogs about Texas's so-called ethics laws. I frequently disagree with his opinions, but his posts are generally thoughtful and interesting. In his post about Empower Texans, Cates shuffles between praise for our legal and legislative strategy, party line condemnation of our distasteful tactics, and musings about 3D chess. At one point, Cates remarks, "My God, what if Empower Texans board chairman Tim Dunn and Empower Texans are actually the ethical stalwarts of Texas? What if indeed?" I get the feeling that it may be starting to sink in for some in the Austin establishment that maybe, just maybe, we at Empower Texans are serious about cleaning up the Austin swamp and are about, as our name indicates, empowering Texans. The party line in Austin amongst the lobby and the court jester media who help promote their agendas is that Empower Texans is just in it for ourselves and our supporters. Frankly, it's not surprising the Austin lobby thinks this way. Most groups in Austin operate to gain access to the halls of power. But we've taken a very different track that leaves us frequently reviled by those in power who fear having their records exposed. We are consistently fighting battles for the good of the community at significant expense. For example, in our 6+ year fight against the Texas Ethics Commission, we've repeatedly passed on opportunities to make the case go away for just $500. For any self-interested organization, that offer would have been a no-brainer. But we're interested in ensuring that Texans are free to petition their public officials without a government permission slip, as is their constitutional right. When faced with frivolous lawsuits designed to silence us, we fought back all the way to the Supreme Court. And now under the Sullivan standard, everyday Texans are guaranteed compensation if they are sued for criticizing their public officials. Likewise, we are currently charting a course for how Texans should respond to frivolous political prosecutions that violate their First Amendment rights. When the Travis County DA appeared interested in abusing an obscure state law to silence our speech, we took them to federal court and put them on the record. The federal court concluded the statute didn't apply, and we were under no fear of prosecution. Empower Texans is only perceived to have power because our agenda isn't really ours. It's the agenda of the people, those who hold real power in our republic. And they, not us, are the ones winning battle after battle, electorally, legislatively, and culturally. Some might mistake our efforts to empower them as an exercise of our own ability. But if we tried to persuade the people to hold their elected officials accountable over issues of interest only to us, we'd simply be tilting at windmills. Rather than engage in a self-defeating effort to do more to wine and dine legislators than their competitors, some of the special interest lobby groups ought to take notice about the power of the people. Take, for example, Cates' organization. He represents the Texas Nurses Association. They are routinely victimized by the more powerful doctors' lobby. To flip that script, they would do better if they worked to get nurses themselves more engaged in Texas politics. Or better yet, they should be appealing directly to the patients those nurses serve to advocate for better care. As for us, we're just trying to do our best to empower Texans to effectively govern themselves. We don't fancy ourselves any sort of knights, the white variety or otherwise. But like the good guys in the westerns of old, we do try to wear a white hat and to fight for Texas values and for the good of all citizens. And we don't wear any disguises. I'm Tony McDonald with this week's Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary.
Thanks, Tony. You know, we do try to wear the white hats here in the state of Texas and let citizens all across the state know the information they need so that they can hold their government accountable. You know, we have a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, and it ought to stay that way. Until next week, this is Texas Scorecard Radio.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.